proceed with the second argument, the court would like to welcome students from the following high schools: Crofton High School, Elkhorn Valley High School, Sioux Falls Christian, Norfolk Senior High, Crofton Boys Ranch, Orchard High School, and Gabriel Wallen High School. The second case for oral argument this morning is Cantaloupe versus the Veterans of Foreign Wars Club of Eureka, South Dakota. For the appellant, Veterans of Foreign Wars, is Mr. Drew Johnson, an attorney from Aberdeen. For the appellee, Jennifer Cantaloupe and James Cantaloupe, is Kimberly Versa, an attorney from Aberdeen. Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, I would like to extend my thanks also to Mount Marty College for allowing us to host these arguments on their campus. I fully support the idea of taking this court to the surrounding areas to allow people to see what we in fact do in this practice of law. I think it's somewhat ironic that my case follows the previous case on smoking, because I will be talking a lot about smoke, and my argument is very important to realize the impediments that smoking does bring to people, including Jennifer Cantaloupe. The facts of my case, I think, are quite clear in the briefs, but in 1996, the VFW Club, which is a club in Eureka, owned and operated by local veterans, mostly from World War II, and they have a facility in Eureka that has a community center type atmosphere, as well as a bar, the typical bar that we all have been in, the bar that has the smoke, the alcoholic beverages, snacks, and that type of thing. In 1996, the VFW Club needed to hire a new manager or managers. They had an ad in the paper in Aberdeen for that position. They advertised it as an 80-hour per week job between two people. Jim and Jennifer Cantaloupe, who were not married at the time but living together, had applied for that job since they lived in Eureka. They were interviewed. However, the interview process was quite abbreviated, and they knew what they were getting when they agreed to come on board and manage the bar for the VFW. The 80 hours a week was paid on an annual salary of $20,800, and that was divided down into 12-month divisions and then paid to each equally. The history of Jennifer Cantaloupe in this case, medically, is quite replete with a severe asthma condition. There are numerous medical records that we went through from her condition that Dr. Tom Ruzier was treating and had treated as a patient. Jennifer was his patient since the 1980s, with numerous incidences of problems with her asthmatic condition. The VFW Club did not know that Jennifer had this problem. She never volunteered that information, and she was hired along with Jim. She worked there starting in April of 1996 up through the summer of 1997. On September 19th of that year, she came down with a coughing episode. She was taken to a hospital overnight, and the next morning she was diagnosed with a ruptured air sac in the airway system. That's apparently quite common to asthmatics when they get into a trigger situation with something that exposes them to an element such as smoke that causes their respiratory system to react adversely. The official name is a name that I don't want to try to pronounce again, but it's one that Jennifer recovered from within 2 weeks. Dr. Luzier said she fully recovered. It was fully resolved within 2 weeks of September 19th. Later, Jim Cantaloupe continued to work at the bar, and he ended up quitting because he thought he wanted more money. Eventually, several months after that, in December of 1997, Attorney Harvey Oliver started a lawsuit against the VFW asking that the court award to the Cantaloupes Jennifer's workers' compensation benefits as well as overtime pay under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Those are the two issues that we're here about today.
She had never had this kind of reaction to smoke prior to this time, though, had she?
Pardon me?
She had never had this type of a reaction to smoke prior to this incident. There was no evidence of that, was there?
The subcutaneous emphysema, that's correct. She did not have an air-ruptured sac, as Dr. Luzier had described it. However, the evidence, and I'll get to that in a minute, clearly showed that even 2 months before September 19th, she was experiencing problems with her asthma because she was working in the bar. She was exacerbating her problem. Now, that was a medical note from Dr. Luzier's medical file that came out after the incident on September 19th, where Jennifer knew she was being exposed to the smoke and was having problems, didn't tell anybody about it, continued to work there, and eventually this incident happened on the September 19th date. This case comes down to what we believe is a fair defense on our behalf, and that's under the willful misconduct statute that's in 62-4-37. It says no compensation shall be allowed for an injury to the employees due to the employee's willful misconduct, including intentional self-inflicted injury. We believe there is self-inflicted injury and willful misconduct here primarily for two reasons. She was a smoker, and also she was advised by her doctor to stay out of smoke environments.
Now, when you say she's a smoker, wasn't there a finding that that was not proven?
There's no finding.
Finding either way.
No.
There was no finding that she was a smoker either, though, correct?
That's correct. The issue of liability on work comp was decided by a summary judgment over our objection. We vigorously resisted that. But in preparation for resisting that, we had three affidavits from neighbors of Jennifer Cantaloupe that lived by and right across the street from Jennifer. And those affidavits were filed with the trial court, and they clearly show that these neighbors saw Jennifer smoking outside of her residence through that entire time frame, 96 and 97.
So the relief you're seeking, then, based on this procedure, is a trial rather than ruling in your favor, correct?
That should have been conducted at a trial, and the trial court finding is correct. But as you get into a summary judgment, you don't have findings of fact, so that was never brought up. But we did present it as a defense, and clearly the judge saw the affidavit, should have seen the affidavits that we filed, and saw our brief that relied upon the statutes that I'll comment on in a minute. But Dr. Luzier, in his deposition on page 16, referred to the AMA Guide to Permanent Impairments on page 155 of that journal, and it says, quote, the most common cause of self-inflicted respiratory impairment is cigarette smoke, end quote. He admitted that Jennifer, if she was in fact smoking, was self-inflicting her own injury.
The injury, however, that this is based on, wasn't smoking the night this injury, or the night, I assume it was the night, that this injury occurred, is that correct? I mean, it wasn't the issue on what caused the cancer?
We don't know. We asked, or I asked during a deposition of Jennifer if she in fact was smoking that night, and she said she did not smoke at that time. We contend that under the statute that talks about 62-7-40, people that testify falsely, their testimony should not be considered. When we had three witnesses that say they saw her during the 2 years that she worked at VFW smoking around her house, it's implausible to think that she did not go to the bar and continued to smoke. But she denied that. The doctor, Dr. Luzier, said that was a material fact in his deposition on his diagnosis of Jennifer's condition, whether or not she was smoking herself, because he agreed that Jennifer's smoking, if she was smoking, would bring about the same kind of problem. But that was overlooked at the trial court level on a summary judgment basis, and it should not have been.
So if we were to agree with you and write this, what we would actually be setting as a precedent or determining is that someone with asthma who smokes is subjecting themselves to willful misconduct and take a job that involves any kind of pollutant in the air that might cause their asthma to react. Is that what you're really saying here? Is that what you're asking this court to do?
I'm asking the court to impose the same type of finding or holding as it did in the Fenner v. Trimac case under that statute about willful misconduct, where a doctor, your treating physician, tells you to stay out of smoke environments, and I'm going to go through that with quotes from the deposition transcript in a minute, then she has to comply with that. And when she fails to do that and gets hurt because of it, there's no reason that this employer, in this case, or any employer in South Dakota, should have to tolerate the payment of work comp benefits in that situation. And just to show you some of the quotes on this very issue, from Dr. Luzera asked, quote, "And to the extent, though, that Jennifer had been exposed to cigarette smoking in her environment in the past, and that caused problems for her, this is nothing new for her in September of 97. Would you agree with that?" His answer, quote, "When she did not have good control of her asthma, she was aware that cigarette smoke would be a potential trigger," end quote. And he further agreed with his deposition, quote, "If you go into a risk situation and do it knowingly and basically out of control, then you will be inflicting injury upon yourself," end quote. And that's what we have that statute for, self-inflicting your own injury. And she was exposing herself to the smoke after clearly being told since early in the 90s to stay away from those places that had smoke. I mean, I can think of hundreds and hundreds of places you can go and find a job without going to a bar where there's all kinds of smoke and you're told to stay out of a smoke environment. It makes no sense. It goes on in his testimony. I asked a question of Dr. Luzera. Quote, "Her history is at least going back to 93 and 94, replete with situations where she'd been in smoke environments before and you told her to stay out of those places," end quote. And Dr. Luzera's answer was, quote, "That's correct," end quote. And he goes on. Another question asked, "As far as avoiding areas where there was smoke in her course of medical treatment for years, that is something you've been telling her to avoid," end quote. Again, his answer, quote, "That's correct," end quote. So we have Jennifer coming in out of control in the last 2 months, July and August of 97, from the own medical records of Jennifer. And she continues to stay there, work there, not known at all by the VFW that she was having these problems or ever had any problem at all. And she comes down with the impairment, the respiratory malfunction. But if she had followed her doctor's advice to stay out of those places, she would not be in the situation that she was in. And that's why this court adopted this phrase out of the Fenner v. Trimac case, and I quote, "The proposition that one may continue or even increase his disability by his willful and unreasonable conduct and then claim compensation from his employer for that disability so caused is untenable." And that's exactly what we are asking this court to do, find that it was untenable for Jennifer to go into that environment, continue with her own smoking, and to stay in a smoke environment with other people who are smoking, come down with this injury, and then blame it on the employer.
You just asked us to find that. Shouldn't a trial court or a fact finder make that finding?
To the extent that there was no facts found by the trial court, as was done on a summary judgment basis, I would agree with that, Justice, that was a trial court function to find that. That she had this advice from the doctor, she ignored it.
And we have no findings to review on this, because it was summary judgment.
That's true.
We have no findings to review.
That's true. And we resisted the summary judgment. We wanted to go to trial and further prove up our case. We were cut short by a summary judgment, not allowing the court to make these findings for himself, so you would have an opportunity to review exactly what he did say. But it has to go without argument that apparently the judge totally ignored our defense on the smoking.
Well, I think we have to assume the judge did look at this in the light most favorable to the non-moving party and still made this determination as a matter of law that this doesn't fit within the definition of willful misconduct.
Correct, but I think this reviewing court can certainly sit in the same position that he is in, since he is not in any better position to find facts because there were no facts to find. And you ask yourself if the evidence that I'm presenting to you is sufficient to support a summary judgment in this area. At least it should go back to a trial on the merits of whether or not these are proper defenses in this case, and not to summarily reject them on a summary judgment basis. I believe this court can do that. We go on to, if I may, the question of the permanent partial and temporary total disability. We only state these in the alternative because we believe the case should be summarily reversed and a finding entered that there was no work-related injury. At least there's this defense that we raise that should be tried by the trial court in its full entirety. So the temporary total, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. We believe the mistake was made because the doctor's advice was to take 2 weeks, and it was fully resolved in 2 weeks. Later on, he did not tell Jennifer that during the course of his treatment. That was a statement he made over a year later that she should take 8 weeks off. There's nothing in her medical record to show that was the case. His deposition said 2 weeks. Also, the permanent partial disability has to be based on an impairment rating taken from the AMA Guide to Permanent Impairment, 4th edition. And it has to be something done by the doctor to test for that. And Dr. Luzier, at page 53 of his deposition, says, quote, "I do not believe I have tested Jennifer specifically for disability impairment rating," end quote. He didn't test her. The one test that he did do was the spirometric testing, which is a breathing test, and he found that in 2 weeks, she had completely resolved that problem, and she was a class 1, zero impairment based on the AMA guide, and that's in his testimony, his deposition. There is nowhere else to go in his testimony to find an impairment rating based on the guide. What he uses is a 10 to 15% loss of employability. And I have that outlined in my brief. And on page 50 of his deposition, quote, he says, quote, "Is your loss that you have down in Exhibit 1, the June 8th letter to Harvey Oliver, of 10 to 15%, based on the fact that her employment is limited now? Is that where you come up with that, Tom?" End quote. Tom being Dr. Tom Luzier. And his answer, quote, "Correct," end quote. He was taking on the role of a vocational rehabilitation expert with absolutely no foundation to that background at all. 10 to 15% is not based on AMA guides at all. If it was, he would have to give her a zero impairment. A zero impairment means no compensation under the statute or the formula that's set up by statute to determine how much a permanent partial disability should be awarded to a work comp claimant. Without it, you don't get it. It's as simple as that. The other question that came up in our trial proceedings is my...
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Requirement for a jury trial on the question of workers' compensation benefits. In my case with the VFW, they did not have insurance. There was a reason for that from years ago that they had a bad experience with workers' comp and dropped it at that time. But in this particular occasion, they did not have it. And
they had a bad experience without workers' comp, huh?
That could be. You're absolutely right. And this is potentially a bad experience for them. But we asked for a jury trial. When the case was sued out in circuit court, we answered and requested a jury trial. We briefed that issue, and Judge Leverpool denied us the opportunity to have a jury trial on the question of work comp. There is no case in South Dakota that I have found that says one way or the other, do you or do you not get a jury trial? I maintain that under the statute, it does allow the case to go into circuit court. It must mean something in connection with a trial proceeding, including a jury trial. Our Constitution allows that or requires that. If this was truly to be a Department of Labor case, like all other work comp cases are handled through the administrative process, then we didn't get that benefit. We were sued in circuit court without a trial, a jury trial, that we asked for. And I think, under our law, it should be
required. Workers' comp was not known in the state at the time our Constitution was adopted.
That's true. It was not. I think it was...
I mean, so you have no claim there.
If that's the finding of the court, then we'll accept that. But it hasn't been ruled on upon by this court at any time in the past, whether or not you do or don't have. I'm contending, though, that if we're to stay inside the work comp title under all the statutes that are involved, that we should go back to the Department of Labor. Let's have an opportunity to have a hearing with the Department of Labor then. Why do we have to bypass all of that? That's what the statute says under the title of work comp.
Did you make any, did you file any motion for to that effect, that it go to the Department?
I did. I included the, in my answer, the affirmative pleading that I asked for a jury trial. We had a hearing before the judge on that very question.
You didn't ask for a hearing in the Department of, front of the Department of Labor?
We did not go to the Department of Labor. We always stayed in circuit court because that's where it was taken or venued, and that's where it it stopped.
Time has expired, Mr. Johnson.
We believe it should be provided. Thank you.
Ms. Dorsett, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. The first issue that I will address concerns the VFW's claim that plaintiff Jennifer committed willful misconduct or self-inflicted her injury by working for the VFW in the night in question. The undisputed facts reveal that on September 19th of 1997, plaintiff Jennifer did suffer from a subcutaneous pneumomediastinum, which is essentially air rupturing into her lungs. This is an injury that she had not suffered from before. There is no medical evidence in the record that establishes she'd even have any indication that she was going to have this problem. The night in question, there was heavy cigar smoke in the bar. That was a unique situation, even admitted by the VFW, who testified in depositions that this bar was not a normally smoky bar. But on this night in question, there were three people smoking cigars right next to where she was pouring drinks. She had a coughing spell, not a basic asthma attack. A coughing spell that caused air to rupture into her neck area, chest area, and she went to the hospital.
Does the evidence, though, tie the injury to her asthmatic condition?
From my understanding of Dr. Rosdier's testimony is that a subcutaneous pneumomediastinum can happen to members of the general public. However, it is more common in asthmatic people.
Did you make a motion for summary judgment to the trial court?
Yes, we did. We based our motion upon the fact that whether or not willful misconduct exists is a question of law that should have been resolved by the court, not by a jury.
But aren't there genuine issues of material fact that relate to that?
We felt there was not. And the reason for that was because Dr. Lazier testified himself that even if she had smoked on the day in question, or even if she did have poor treatment of her asthma in the years prior to 1996, that was not the major contributing cause of the injury on the night in question. And because of the uncontradicted medical testimony presented to the trial court at summary judgment, he made a ruling that it was not willful misconduct. That's the only evidence that he had was the testimony of Dr. Lazier. The defendant did not come forward with their own medical evidence to contradict Dr. Lazier's opinion. And as the employer, they had the burden to come forward and prove their defense, which they didn't do. The trial court even mentioned, as you'll see from the summary judgment transcript, that defendant VFW did not come forward with any medical evidence to contradict that causation opinion by Dr. Lazier, and that's the basis for their opinion.
Doesn't Judge Dobbin have to make findings of fact at least in his own mind, before he can reach the point of ruling on a legal question of whether or not those facts constitute as a matter of law, neither willful misconduct nor self-inflicted injury?
There was not specific findings made as far as the summary judgment order issued by the court. The judge just made a ruling from the bench.
Right, but doesn't he have to do that, whether he does it in his head or in paper or on the record? He's got to do that before he ever gets to the point of ruling that there's neither self-inflicted injury nor willful misconduct.
Correct, and we felt that he did that.
Okay, but you can't do that on summary judgment, can you? If there's genuine issues of material fact, you can't reach summary judgment.
But that's the point. It goes back to whether the disputes of fact were material. Jennifer denied smoking. The purported witnesses never came forward to testify. Dr. Rozier, even though presented to the court, it doesn't matter. So because of the fact that the issues of dispute don't matter, he ruled upon causation issues.
Well, then what did Mr. Johnson mean when he argued, in brief, the fact that the doctor said smoking was a material question in regard to this?
Yes, correct. That was relating to prior, if you review Dr. Rozier's deposition and trial transcript, trial testimony in its entirety, he's referring to prior years. In 1996 and 1997, Dr. Rozier testified that Jennifer had good control of her asthma, and that because of that good control, the prior admonitions of staying out of smoky environments did no longer apply. He testified that he never ordered her not to work in the bar. He knew about her working in the bar 2 to 3 months prior to the September 19th incident. Nonetheless, he did not tell her to change jobs. He did not tell her to quit working. And that's the critical point here. He never ordered her not to do that.
I'm confused a little bit about the procedure. The judge granted summary judgment, but you just mentioned that the doctor had trial testimony.
Oh, excuse me, I misspoke.
It was just a deposition. It was a doctor's deposition.
Correct.
All right.
Given that, the trial court based its ruling upon the causation issue. Again, the Dr. Lazier had the opinion that even if she had smoked on the day in question and poor treatment of her asthma prior to then, that was not the major contributing cause of her injury. The next issue that we wanted to address concerns the award for temporary total disability. Now, this is the award that Plaintiff Jennifer was entitled to because of the eight-week period where she was completely unable to work. Now, as defense counsel has stated, the subcutaneous pneumomediastinum did resolve itself within 2 weeks. However, he testified at trial before the court and explained that the other 6 weeks was the healing process that he ordered her to undergo. This is similar to a patient who has a severe heart attack. Yes, the heart attack may be resolved itself within a matter of days, but it's that high risk of re-injury afterwards where the patient is not supposed to work, is supposed to rest, and allow the body to heal. He explained that she was ordered on bed rest for a period of 8 weeks because she needed to heal and the risk of re-injury was extremely high. That was the basis for his opinion, and that is not contradicted by any other medical evidence. As to the award for permanent partial disability, again, Dr. Rozier testified at trial. He relied upon the medical history of Jennifer. He had been her lifelong doctor. He relied upon her examinations of her, and he did use the guides. He never admitted he didn't use the guides. He stated he relied on the guides, but he admitted that asthma is a very difficult condition to use the strict applications of the guides for because of its episodic condition. The preamble to the guide states that they cannot cover every single type of injury that a human may suffer from. Therefore, medical practitioners are afforded discretion in coming with the impairment. Again, they're supposed to use the spirit of the guides. Also, asthma is mentioned within the guides as being a very difficult condition to render an impairment rating on because of that very nature, which is why you have to go back and rely on your medical doctors and just establish that they did rely on the medical history and medical review of their own patient. And again, this is uncontradicted testimony. if the defendant wanted to contradict Dr. Lazier's impairment rating, then it was their duty to come forward with another medical expert to review her and render their own opinion, so the trial court had to decide between the two, but that was not done.
Now, the doctor testified about loss of employability. Mr. Johnson just argued to us that the doctor said that he did no impairment rating. I understand that.
I feel that was a misstatement of the doctor's testimony. He
used those words, though.
Dr. Lazier?
Yes.
I don't believe that he did. I think if he did, it was probably just a portion taken out of his deposition, but the whole, as a whole, Dr. Lazier testified, I did review her for whether or not she was disabled as a result of this injury. He went through and explained that I had to make a determination whether she is going to be at a disadvantage employment-wise in the future because of this injury. And again, his basis is the high risk of re-injury that did not exist prior to her suffering from this mediastinum.
So you're arguing that that's equivalent to a medical impairment rating. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and again, based on the guide's explanations as to how to arrive at impairment ratings and affording the medical practitioners the discretion that's needed for asthma conditions. The next issue touched on by defense counsel was the entitlement to a jury trial in workers' compensation cases. We maintain that no such right does exist in workers' compensation cases. When an employer chooses to operate within the title, there's no dispute there's no right to a jury trial. It's an administrative proceeding, and it's a right that was developed by our legislature. It did not exist at common law, and therefore there is no right to a jury trial unless the legislature prescribes one. In this particular case, the employer was not operating within the title because they chose not to carry workers' compensation insurance. However, if you look to the legislative scheme, SDCL 62-3-11 specifically provides that an employee may elect to proceed in circuit court against the employer under the provisions of this title, in quoting, as if the employer had elected to operate thereunder. We therefore maintain the position that, in this case, the plaintiff elected to proceed in circuit court under the provisions of the title. And therefore, the provisions of the title apply, which means no right to a jury trial. This is further consistent with the policy behind the workers' compensation statutes. We believe our legislature wanted to promote employers staying within the title and in maintaining workers' compensation insurance. Allowing the VFW to have a jury trial in this instance would be effectively affording them more rights than an employer would have who chose to operate within the title. We feel that that result would encourage people not to carry workers' compensation insurance. There would be inconsistency where some people had to stay, you know, had a right to a jury trial where others didn't. We feel that across the board, workers' compensation claims are not entitled to jury trials. My final points concern our issues of appeal. Plaintiff James and Jennifer also submitted a claim under the Fair Labor Standards Act and the corresponding South Dakota laws. They maintain that, excuse me, because of the statute, that because of the salary that they were paid and the number of hours that they were required to put in per week, resulted in them not being paid overtime and resulted in them being paid below the applicable minimum wage.
Was there a written contract or was it an oral agreement?
It was an oral agreement. when you're going to submit a claim for overtime, the issue of actual or constructive knowledge of the overtime being worked becomes an issue. Now, whether that exists is a question of fact. And as the employee, we were required to come forth with a prima facie case to establish that the employer did have constructive knowledge, and if so, then we're entitled to a trial by jury. At the trial court level, we presented what we believe to be evidence, prima facie evidence, excuse me, that the employees, James and Jennifer, were working overtime. We had the admitted testimony of Harley Wolf and Walden Kallenberger, who were members of the VFW, that they saw them working together on numerous occasions. We had hiring notes that were, at the time of James and Jennifer's hiring, notes were taken by VFW members, and it said, manager and/or helper to be present at all times. That right there infers that there will be times when both of them will be working. Hurley also testified that past managers in that same capacity had worked together on several occasions.
So, excuse me, is this a fairly erroneous standard then that we're reviewing on the findings of fact?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking us to?
Yeah, we feel that the court did err when obviously he must have ruled that we didn't make a prima facie showing of constructive knowledge.
Now, the court didn't make an initial determination on whether they're exempt from the wage and hour law, did they?
No, and that was our second point of appeal. We asked the court to rule upon those questions of law, whether the administrative exemption applied to the overtime or whether the retail and service establishment exemption applied. The court didn't rule on either of those issues.
Did he make any explanation on why?
No.
Did you make a motion for summary judgment on this issue also?
We made a motion for summary judgment. It was a second motion for summary judgment on the issue of the exemption applicability.
And that was resisted by Mr. Johnson?
Yes. And the trial court, at the conclusion of the hearing, just ruled there are disputed issues of fact and set the matter for trial. So the issue of exemptions was never ruled upon. And should this court find that the trial court should have allowed us to present the issue of overtime to the jury, then the issues of the exemptions needs to be resolved prior to that trial.
No jury was ever selected. You simply were at a summary judgment motion on this also then, right?
Correct, correct. And then at the conclusion of the actual court trial, the court ruled that because no actual...
Now, what court trial? You mean the determination of the summary judgment?
No. Procedurally, we brought forth two separate motions for summary judgment, and there was also a court trial held.
And there was a court trial on what issue?
Actually, several issues. The trial court heard evidence as to the workers' compensation award to which plaintiff James and Jennifer would have been entitled. So there's issues of temporary total disability and permanent partial disability. We also put forth evidence as to our prima facie showing of constructive knowledge as to the overtime. And those were the issues. And correspondingly, the court could have ruled at that time, if it wanted to, on the whether or not the exemptions applied. So all those issues were presented at the trial court. Before the court trial.
So I'm kind of confused then. If the court went ahead and made the determination about the overtime, didn't the court in effect rule on your? I mean, by not ruling, wasn't the exemption did not apply?
Right. The trial court did render those issues moot by ruling that no actual or constructive knowledge existed. Our point of appeal is that should this court make a determination that we should have been allowed to present our case to the jury, then that next issue, we have to take it one step further and rule on those exemptions beforehand.
But we could reverse it and could find that the exemption applies, which would then, you'd be out of it.
I thought
you'd be out that way, too.
I'm sorry. Are you done? Yeah. I thought you earlier said that the trial court, on this second question, ruled that there were genuine issues of material fact and then didn't rule on your question. In other words, you said he found that there were genuine issues of material fact and he ruled that it'd be for trial.
The second summary judgment motion, we presented issues as to her entitlement to a disability award. At the first summary judgment motion, the trial court ruled that plaintiff Jennifer suffered from a compensable injury, thereby rejecting the defense arguments of willful misconduct and self-inflicted injury. After that concluded...
I don't want to go back to that one again, but I want to get to the point of what did he rule was set for trial?
At the second summary judgment motion, we therefore moved for a determination as to both the exemptions and Jennifer's entitlement to compensation. So both of those issues were presented to the trial court at the second summary judgment motion hearing. Rather than ruling on each one of them separately, he just flatly denied it. So we're not sure exactly what he meant by disputed issues of material fact, to be honest.
You're saying you don't know whether it's under exemption or whether it's under constructive knowledge. Is that what you're saying?
Right. We don't know if it was on those issues or if he meant it as to the issues of compensation and disability entitlement. Because we presented both of them.
Well, didn't you? Who prepared the order that the judge then signed?
We both did. And we just ruled that we just restated what he said, that there was issues of material fact as to both issues.
Did anybody prepare a proposed order as to what they wanted?
Yes.
Rather than what the judge wanted to do? In other words, were there objections to the order stated on the record?
No, there was not.
You have approximately a minute and a half left.
Thank you. In closing, I just want to touch again on the misconduct and self-inflicted injury issue. Again, there was no evidence that Jennifer was not in control of her asthma during the relevant time period to this case, which is the time immediately around the injury. Also, it is important to note that Dr. Lazier testified he never ordered her not to work in the bar. He even knew that she was working there a couple months prior to the injury. He did not tell her to change jobs. He did not tell her not to be working. So to hold plaintiff Jennifer to a higher standard than what her doctor predicted would happen to her would be an error in this case. Dr. Lazier testified this is an unpredictable and unforeseeable injury, and that medical opinion and evidence as to causation was not disputed at the trial court level. There was no contradictory medical evidence upon which the court could base its decision, and that is why the summary judgment was issued at the time that it was. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Again, may it please the court, the question has come up about whether or not Dr. Lazier knew that she was working in a bar before this incident on September 19th. And the answer to that, clearly stated in the deposition transcript, is he did not know she was smoking or working in a bar. The note that shows that she was having problems with the smoke in the bar for 2 months before this incident occurred is on page 38 of his deposition transcript. And I specifically point out in my question that I was reading from his medical note that he took on September 20th, the day after the incident on September 19th, where he refers back to the fact that she had been having problems working in the bar for 2 months before September 19th. It was nothing that he knew and then said, go ahead and do it anyway. That's a misstatement of the record before this court.
But he does make the finding, or he does make the voice the opinion, however, that did not was not a cause of her injury, doesn't he?
The smoke in the bar wasn't the cause?
Right, it was this incident.
But the smoke, there's no question the smoke in the bar caused her problem medically, and it was caused because she was asthmatic. She had had these kind of problems in the past, true, not to the level or extent that she had here, but she had respiratory problems in the past. She lived with a roommate back in 93 that smoked. He told her, get out of the apartment that he smokes in. Couldn't do that. She worked at a place that had chemical fumes in the air as a hairdresser. He told her, you can't work there. Stay out of that place. He told her, avoid smoke environments throughout his medical course of treatment of her. This is the order, advice, instruction, whatever you want to call it, under the Fenner rationale that will disqualify somebody from receiving these benefits.
Given all that, counsel suggests that, and the doctor testified, that it was the cigar smoke, that there was not the usual smoke in the bar. As I understand it, he indicated there was cigar smoke, and that was what was the contributing cause of this injury. So therefore, all of those things aren't material.
That's true. He said that, but he wasn't there, Justice. He had openly admitted that. He was not in the bar. The person that was smoking the cigar that night has an affidavit in the file that says, yes, he was. But if anybody was objecting to the smoke, he would have put it out, number one. Number two, he didn't think it was that bad. And number three, Jennifer never complained about it at all.
Says it's not material, the general atmosphere of the bar it's not material, then the trial court was correct. There is no material.
On page 15 of his deposition transcript, he admitted that knowing whether or not Jennifer was smoking herself was a material fact in his overall diagnosis and the opinion he gave in this case. He did not know that. And on page 15, he clearly says if he had known that, his opinion might be different.
Did you? But you did not present any conflicting testimony, though, by an expert, did you?
When their doctor is my best witness, Justice, I submit I don't need to bring in another high-paying physician. There is a case that talks about that, the Parker's case, that talks about you take your witnesses as you find them. And I take a quote from the Parker's case in 96. It says, quote, a party may not claim a better version of the facts than his own testimony, period, end quote. It makes no difference if I have another doctor who would come in and say, yeah, she's asthmatic, she should never have been in the bar. It's clear in the testimony of Dr. Luzier that she shouldn't have been in the bar. She was having problems. She was not under control in 96 and 97. Going back to 93, he told her many times, stay out of those places. He doesn't have to say, stay out of a bar. It's just stay out of the smoke environments. And she didn't follow that advice or that order or that instruction. And it's all synonymous with the same meaning under this willful conduct, misconduct statute, that she did not comply with her doctor's advice to stay out of those places and not smoke herself. There was a question about the permanent partial disability. The statute, and the only way you get permanent partial in South Dakota on the work comp is if you have an AMA guide type impairment rating. Based on the AMA guide, the doctor says it doesn't give you one. Well, then you don't get one. You can't go out and make one up. This court should not be asked to revise the law. The statute clearly says under 62-1-1.2 that you need an impairment rating from the guide. He says in his testimony, again, on page 50, when I asked about the 10 to 15% impairment that he gave, he agreed that was not on the AMA guide. That was an employability impairment. Now, he can't give that. He is not qualified to give that. It's not anything that will support the $8,800-some worth of compensation that the lower court awarded to Jennifer in this case. She simply doesn't get it because he can't base it on the guide. There's nowhere else to go to get it. And he openly admits on page 50 that he didn't use the guide to do that. There's a question about the summary judgment motion and whether or not these are material facts. I think they're all material facts that I'm bringing up here, and it should have been allowed to go to the fact finder. My opposition says that I didn't bring forth any witnesses to show that she was. You don't bring forth witnesses in a summary judgment proceeding. You base it on the pleadings, the depositions, the interrogatory answers, and affidavits. I had affidavits from her neighbors that clearly showed that she was a smoker in those time frames involved, and she denied it. She falsely denied it. She didn't tell her doctor she was smoking. She didn't tell the hearing or the judge in this case, sometimes a hearing examiner, but she didn't tell the judge that she was smoking because it would have kicked her case out clearly and squarely had she in fact admitted that. So under that statute, where you have false testimony, you can ignore her entire testimony and therefore defeat her claim on that basis. I think the question about the jury trial again, if my opposition wants to go back and have a jury trial on the issue of overtime, then let's go back and have a jury trial at the same time on the question of workers' compensation benefits then too, if this court doesn't first reject the trial court's ruling in that regard. But getting back to the overtime pay, one of the elements of whether or not the Cantaloupes can acquire overtime pay here is whether or not the employer knew that they were putting in overtime.
Are you conceding that the court got past the exemption part of it and that basically went right to whether or not they were entitled?
The exemptions that I believe Ms. Dorsett talks about are the exemptions for the white collar exemption, if I may. Administrative type job where...
Well, there was quite a bit of testimony about whether or not they were managers and what that entailed.
That's right. And that was not decided by the trial court. He first decided the issue of whether or not the employer, the VFW Club, knew that the cantaloupes were putting in overtime.
That's kind of getting the cart before the horse, isn't it? Wouldn't you have to first decide whether or not they were even fall within the overtime statutes?
I think for the sake of the record, we admitted that we were their employer, the cantaloupes' employer, number one. And number two, they were hired as managers, yes. But I think before you have to decide that question, even if they are covered by overtime and we have to pay it, you first have to ask if the employer knew that they were putting in overtime. And the judge answered this question first before he had to answer the second question. So the second question is unanswered in this record. But it's clear in the record, Jennifer herself said she never told the employer that she was putting in overtime. The only time overtime ever came up was from Jim, and that was at the very tail end of his employment there. And the commander of the VFW and several others said they did not know they were putting in overtime. They're saying here in this record that there's only several incidences where they were working that they may have both been there at the same time. Jennifer clearly says we worked 80 hours a week. We split it equally between the two of us. That's 40 hours. That's within the Fair Labor Standards Act. They had opportunities to hire other people if they needed more work done than they were able to do. And they, in fact, did take advantage of that. So under the Graham case that I've put forth in my brief, employer does not know here that there was overtime to pay, and therefore they're not obligated to pay it. And we think the trial court was correct in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.